Good evening, Frank. Welcome to the Space Show.
Thank you very much. Nice to see you, Andy.
A few years ago, our Mount Stromlo here in Canberra got burnt down.
Yes.
Apparently one of your observatories in the United States is facing this similar fate.
Yes, just today in Arizona, Kitt Peak Observatory, which is one of the premier observatories in the world, is now under threat today of a forest fire, which is, last I heard, about 2 miles away from the telescopes. So as you might expect, we're very nervous, and we hope that the wind does not shift in such a way that we have a big problem there.
You work there.
I do work there. I work for the National Solar Observatory, and we have the world's largest solar telescope, the McMath Pierce, is up on Kitt Peak, as well as an instrument known as SOLIS, which does observations of the sun's magnetic field. So we have a lot of instrumentation up there. There's many more nighttime telescopes up there as well. So it's quite a big installation.
Is that quite a worrying time for you
today?
It's
a little worrisome, yes. Yes, it is a little worrisome. I was watching a webcam. We have webcams up on the observatory, and you could quite clearly see smoke from the 4-meter telescope that's up there. It's a little nerve-wracking.
So what, Frank, is the role of the National Solar Observatory?
Well, the National Solar Observatory is the main place in the U.S. where any solar astronomers can apply for telescope time and use our facilities. We have a number of facilities, as well as the ones on Kitt Peak that I mentioned to you. We also have facilities in the state of New Mexico on a mountain called Sacramento Peak, and we live in a town called Sunspot there, and there's three more solar telescopes there. Sunspot has a population of 60 and has three solar telescopes, so it's by far the most solar telescopes per capita than anywhere else in the world. In addition, we run the GONG program, which is a network of observatories, small instruments around the world. So the National Solar Observatory is open for researchers all around the world to use our facilities and do research into solar physics.
So, named Sunspot, obviously someone's got a sense of humor.
Yes, someone does. In fact, not only do they have a sense of humor, the sewage plant, which is just outside the gates, is known as Penumbra, which is, in case your listeners don't know, that's the outer part of a sunspot. So,
okay. Well, perhaps, Frank, you could describe the instruments for us.
Sure. The instruments that we have several types. We have the McMath Pierce, which is a 500-foot-long solar telescope. Solar telescopes are rather different from nighttime telescopes, if your listeners may be more familiar with those. Nighttime telescopes need to be light buckets. There's not too many photons, of course, that come from the nighttime stars, and so you need to gather each and every last one of them. The sun, obviously, is much brighter because it's much closer to us, and we have photons to spare, and our problem more is to get rid of the photons so we don't melt our instruments, and we want high resolution. So in terms of, if you're a photographer, we have a very high, slow telescope, an F30, F50 beams for solar, and typical nighttime telescopes are F2. So they're very different in design. They're very long devices. So the McMath Pierce is 500 feet long and has a 2-meter mirror. We have another telescope, the Dunn Solar Telescope, which is evacuated. That's another thing we have to do, is try to get rid of the air, which gets heated up, becomes turbulent, and causes turbulence inside the telescope. So one strategy to do that is to remove the air from the path, and that's one of the things we've done with one of our telescopes.
So the problem is a bit like heat haze.
Yes, that's right.
Or heat shimmering.
Absolutely. It's exactly heat shimmering off of a road in the summertime. It's very much like that. And we have other specialized instruments. One is called SOLIS, which does vector magnetic field measurements. That one's at Kitt Peak. And we have lots of very specialized instrumentation attached to our telescopes. So it's quite a variety of things we have. One of them also is GONG, the Global Oscillation Network Group. And that is a set of actually six instruments. They are very small. They only have about a 10-centimeter aperture. But there are six of them, and they are situated around the world. One of them actually is in Australia. It's over on the west coast at Learmonth, which is quite close to Exmouth, that little fingertip that sticks out on the west coast of Western Australia. And we have one there, and we have one in Udaipur, India. We have one in the Canary Islands off the coast of Africa. It's actually Spanish territory. One in Chile in South America, one in California at Big Bear Lake, and one in Hawaii at Mauna Loa. So those are the six that we have placed around the world.
So quite an international program, then.
It's extremely international. Solar physics in general is international, and the oscillation work is extraordinarily international. So it gives me an opportunity to come visit Australia, which is quite a wonderful place to be.
I've often wondered, do you have enough telescopes to be able to observe the sun 24 hours a day.
Yes, yes, that is what the gong was designed to do. It was designed to observe the sun constantly, 24 hours a day, nonstop, as much as possible. And the way you do that is, well, there's a few strategies. One is to go into space. You can go into a fully sunlit orbit, and there is such a satellite that does that. It's called SOHO. It has been up there since 1995. I'm sure most of your listeners have heard of it because it produces much of the spectacular images you see these days. It is aging, and it will be replaced by another one called as the Solar Dynamics Observatory, SDO, and that will be launched in 2008. But, of course, space missions are very expensive, and if they break, they are inaccessible orbits. So we decided to put instruments around the world, and we overlap them, so we have two or three instruments observing at all times, and that way we can see the sun basically 90% of the time, round the clock, forever. And we can go fix them when they break.
Talking of the observatory at Learmonth, who owns it? Who operates it?
It's actually operated by the Ionospheric Prediction Service. They have their headquarters in Sydney here. So they run that in cooperation. I believe there's also contingents of Air Force, U.S. Air Force personnel there as well. But mainly it's for the Ionospheric Prediction Service. As you know, solar activity is very important for telecommunications. And the ionosphere, which is the layer of charged particles in the Earth's atmosphere, monitoring its condition is very important. For telecommunications, long-range telecommunications, and so that's why the service originally put the observatory out there.
So obviously we've come a long way from the days of Galileo and observing sunspots and back in 1610.
That's correct.
And gong, how does it work? What do you actually see with it?
Well, what we actually watch is we watch the surface of the sun bounce up and down as the sun is filled with sound. You can think of it as a huge musical instrument, very much like a ringing bell. And like a piano has 88 notes, the sun has about 5 million different notes. And what we do is we can measure the frequencies, the tones of these notes, by watching the surface of the sun move up and down, basically using the Doppler shift of the light that comes off of it, very much like a passing ambulance has a Doppler shifted sound to you. We can then take the pattern of motion up and down and disentangle it into these 5 million different frequencies, and those frequencies depend very sensitively on what the inside of the sun is like. So we can then deduce the entire conditions of the sun. We can actually look inside the sun by listening to the sounds that is trapped inside of it. So it's a wonderful, it's amazing to think we could do this. We had no idea 50 years ago that we could do this sort of thing.
So you're obviously not listening directly to the sound.
No.
More like watching a musical instrument, like a string on a guitar or a bouzouki or something like that, vibrating, and from that you know it's making sound.
That's correct. That's exactly right. You can visualize sound in a lot of different ways. There is something called Chladni patterns, where if you take a disc and put sand on it and then rub the edge of the disc, the sand will go into all the nodes and give you a pattern. It's similar in some ways to that. We watch the pattern of the waves, interference pattern on the solar surface to do this.
So what are you finding out about the sun then with gong?
We found out many things. One of the big surprises was it rotates in a very bizarre way. The surface of the sun, you may or may not know, rotates differentially. The equator has a higher rotation rate, a little shorter period than the poles do. It's as if the day at Darwin was shorter than the days in Melbourne because of the latitude difference. Well, we have found that pattern persists inwards to the sun, and then mysteriously and abruptly it disappears, and the very interior of the sun rotates solidly with the same rotation rate no matter what latitude you're at. This is very strange.
It's not because the sun itself is solid at that.
No. The sun is definitely not solid. It is definitely a plasma and a gas all the way through to the core, from the core to the surface. But all of a sudden, the rotation, the interior part of it below the convection zone, starts to rotate as a solid body. And as I said, this is was completely unexpected and basically destroyed a whole segment of theories as to how the solar magnetic field was generated. And it took that field until about now to try to recover. And now they have ideas that we are now actively trying to detect the phenomena they need to see if they're right, or we could give them another problem. So. That's one of the most amazing things that helioseismology has come up with so far.
Where to next then?
Well, right now there is a lot of interest in trying to predict activity, solar activity. The sunspots that come and go create flares, and as I mentioned, that creates problems for telecommunications as well as many other things in our technologically advanced society, like global positioning system, GPS, power grids, pipelines. All of these things are sensitive to solar activity, and there's quite a bit of effort in trying to predict what has now become known as space weather, and that is what the sun does, when it does it, and how it affects us here on Earth. And seeing as the origin of activity, solar activity, is in the interior, we are now very much engaged in trying to determine how to predict that particular activity. And we have some tantalizing clues. It turns out that under sunspots that have very strong flares in them, there are these solar tornadoes underneath the sunspots. Actually, it's a pair of them, it looks like, and they are oppositely opposed, and they are pushing against each other. And we have found that every sunspot that has a very strong flaring, produces a lot of flares, has this pattern below it. And we are now know that this pattern seems to change in time. There seems to be a very strong pattern that is present before a flare goes off, and then it abruptly decreases as the flare occurs. So we are really hopeful that this will help us to predict flares and help us all in society.
So how exactly does a solar flare affect the Earth?
Well, a solar flare is an abrupt, huge explosion that emits a lot of charged particles, protons, electrons, and heavier ions into the interplanetary space. They're called coronal mass ejections. And if they are directed right at us, they will hit the Earth's magnetic field. We are surrounded by a magnetic field. They will shake that magnetic field, and that will disrupt the ionosphere and also produce a lot of interference with radio communications. And the particles themselves can destroy satellites, and it can be lethal to astronauts who are out on spacewalks, as well as expose passengers in near polar flights to radiation risks and flight crews as well. So it's mainly the charged particles and the X-rays that come out of the flare that affect us.
Now, obviously, the operators of satellite systems would need to know this sort of information.
Yes, they do.
Commercial operators. What about the military?
Yes, the military is very interested in this. The Air Force has been studying space weather and solar physics since World War II, and it's probably not a very well-known fact, but the U.S. Air Force actually funded a lot of solar physics in the U.S. and still does. In fact, one of the observatories that I work at, the Sacramento Peak Observatory, was originally founded by the U.S. Air Force back in 1947. And since then, they are very keenly interested in space weather. And in fact, the installation at Learmonth is one of their observatories in their system to actually monitor the processes that drive space weather.
So where to next?
Well, where to next for us? We're going to continue to work on the space weather problem. We are continuing to try to unravel the secrets of how the magnetic field is generated all in the sun, which requires some really delicate measurements, which I have to say are a little bit beyond our grasp at the moment. And we're trying to devise ways to actually measure some of the things that we need to do, particularly a north-south flow of material, which is approximately 300,000 kilometers below the surface of the sun and is about as fast as you can walk. And so as you can imagine, it is a little hard to detect something like that. So we're working on ways to do that. So I think that's the direction we're going in right now.
And the new satellite, what role will that have?
The new satellite will, again, allow us to monitor the sun. It'll, from the space without the Earth's atmosphere being a problem, we like to look at some of the higher frequencies, the higher spatial frequencies, and the Earth's atmosphere, of course, blurs, is seen in it, there's turbulence, and that degrades the image you can get. This new satellite will allow us to get away from that and allow us to see very fine structures and allow us to see what the acoustic waves are doing immediately below the surface of the sun, which is a very difficult place for us to analyze because there's so much going on there. So that's what SDO will do for us.
Well, I hope that Kitt Peak doesn't suffer the same fate as Mount Stromlo.
Well, I hope so too. I'm going to go check my webcam in a little while, see what's happening.
Okay. Thanks for joining us on the Space Show.
You're quite welcome. Good to talk to you.